This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. For nearly four decades, the Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now, better known as ACORN, has tried to be a voice and a power for poor people in America. This week, undercover videos show that ACORN employees advised clients not to break the law, prompted the House and Senate to cut off federal funds to the group. For more on the politics at play, we're joined by NPR News analyst Juan Williams. Juan, thanks very much for being with us.
Good to see you, Scott.
And ACORN has had its controversies, but there's certainly been something special about these videos. And let's listen to a clip, if we could, from undercover video made at the Baltimore ACORN office. And two people, one posing as Forgive Me this early in the morning, the pimp, another a prostitute, tell ACORN housing representatives they want to bring in underage girls from El Salvador to the United States, and the ACORN rep tells them how to skirt the law to get a housing loan.
And they could be trans dudes, they could be anything.
Okay.
You mean they come to your house, they're exchange students, you just don't...
Exchange students, maybe we can classify them.
Exactly.
Okay.
So, don't worry, you're fine. Thank you.
Now, ACORN says these are isolated incidents and points out that some other offices refused to bite and says workers at the Philadelphia office actually called the police. Could there be other explanations at work here?
Well, not really. It's sort of indefensible. But Bertha Lewis, who's the chief organizer, has said, you know, it's a handful of employees. Mm-hmm. And many other places that these videographers went to pull this stunt, they didn't get ACORN employees to bite, so to speak. But there is no defense for what you see on the tape. It's interesting, though, you could argue that it's entrapment, and some have. Others say, no, this is just good investigative journalism, the kind of thing that, 60 Minutes or one of the other TV magazines might do. But, it's interesting. Bob Borsage, who's a left-wing activist here in Washington, said he thought that a lot of this videotaping was McCarthyite, and it really harped on minor failings and distorted admirable work that ACORN has done over the years. It's been around since the 70s, helping low-income people around the country.
Has there been a divide in the media over covering this story?
Sure has. If you look at it, I think the most celebrated moment this week was when Charlie Gibson of ABC was on a radio show and asked about this ACORN controversy. And he said, oh, it's just something you leave to the cables. And it really fed the idea that especially conservative media feels that mainstream media is left-leaning and ignores a major controversy about this group breaking the law. Jon Stewart, who normally would be perceived as left-leaning and with his Daily Show, however, has played up the absurdity of these two people dressed up as a pimp and a prostitute and the fact that these workers were actually trying to help them with their illegal enterprises. Planned Parenthood has said that the same group has stung them and got people on their lines to say, oh, yes, you can donate funds directly just for the abortion of black babies. And they say, you know, these people are just setting folks up and trying to embarrass them for political reasons.
Mm-hmm. So is this a proxy controversy at this point?
A proxy? Yes, I think President Obama is really much of the target. You know, this group last year, in terms of voter registration, and they're under investigation for voter registration fraud, but got about 1 million people to register to vote. And a lot of people think that this is the right wing firing back at them and trying to pull them away from Democratic political causes.
NPR News analyst Juan Williams, thanks.
You're welcome.
You can dance, you can jive, but you can't see. ABBA on a reunion tour. The Swedish pop group broke up more than a quarter century ago. Their worldwide fame has never stopped growing, thanks in part to the musical Mamma Mia, based on the band's hits, including Take a Chance on Me and Come On, You're Beginning to Sing It Already, Aren't You? Dancing Queen. In fact, nearly all of ABBA's great hits were written by Benny Andersson and Björn Ulvaeus. Now they're back in New York City with another musical. This one is called Christina. It's the first time the popular Swedish performance has been translated into English. It'll run at Carnegie Hall for just two nights next week. Mr. Anderson and Mr. Ulvaeus join us from the rehearsal studio in Carnegie Hall, where they're gearing up for their debut. Gentlemen, thanks very much for being with us.
No, it's a pleasure.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Hi. Mr. Anderson, what's Christina about?
It's an epic novel written in around the 1950s by the author Wilhelm Moberg, and it's a story about how 25% of the Swedish population moved to America. And it's concentrated on one specific family where Christina is the wife of her husband, Karl Oskar, and their struggle to get a better life on this side of the ocean. Mm.
So, Mr. Ulvaeus, I can see why you'd want to bring a show like this to America.
Yeah, it's very much an American saga, and it's always been a dream with us ever since we wrote it to be able to present it like this to an American audience. And there couldn't be a better place to do that than at Carnegie Hall.
Yeah. We'll explain, based on what we've heard, the music from Christina. It's not pop-powered like it is in Mamma Mia. A little more operatic.
Yeah, and that's the reason that we choose Carnegie Hall to present it, because it is a symphonical piece. There's very little dialogue, but the narrator who fills in so the audience will be able to follow what's going on.
Mm. Well, let's listen a bit to the piece, You Have to Be There.
She's a very religious woman, Christina, and she is all of a sudden she is not sure whether he exists or not. And it means a lot to her, and it means a lot to the whole story, actually.
And who do we hear singing?
Her name is Helen Sjöholm. She did Christina in Stockholm, Gothenburg, and at the Malmö Opera as well in Sweden between 1990 and 1995. She's also on the original record. So the first thing we did, actually, before we decided the dates at Carnegie Hall, we asked her if she was available and if she wanted to do this, because we were so sure of Helen that she could pull this off. So she is with us now here.
And I gather, actually, you wrote Christina before Mamma Mia.
Yeah, well how, you look at it. How you look at it, because the first song in Mamma Mia, one of the first songs that we wrote for Mamma Mia was 35 years ago. That's Waterloo. But you're right. You can say that Mamma Mia was compiled after we had written Christina.
Is it true that an American consortium offered $1 billion to bring ABBA back together, Mr. Anderson?
That's what we were told by our agent, but I don't think we saw the money on the table, really.
Mm. So is that why you said no?
We said no because I think it's good that the people out there remember us as we were when they listened to the music, rather than one of those groups that came back because of the money.
Mr. Ulvaeus, when people talk about ABBA, do you separate that from yourselves somehow?
Yes, absolutely. I'm sort of aware of the phenomenon, the fact that we're still around so very much after all these years. But it's very, very difficult, you know, to understand why us.
So speaking analytically, because as the two of you say, you can kind of step back from ABBA, what made this Swedish music group still today one of the most popular music ensembles in the world, in history?
I don't know. Maybe the fact that we're not Anglo-Saxon, that we come from a little country up north, and that it has influences from other styles of music than it would have if we were born here in the U.S. or in England.
If you change your mind, take a chance on the first in line. Honey, I'm still free. Take a chance on me. If you need me, let me know. Gonna be around. If you got no place to go when you're feeling down.
I don't know what it is. If we knew what it was and anybody else knew what it was, it wouldn't be so difficult.
Gentlemen, wonderful talking to you. Good luck.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Benny Andersson and Bjorn Ulvaeus, they're in New York preparing for the U.S. debut of their new musical, Christina. It opens next week at Carnegie Hall for a couple of performances. Thanks very much, gentlemen.
Bye.
Bye.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad of Iran will address the UN General Assembly in New York next week. It's not known right now if there will be any kind of contact between U.S. and Iranian officials during his visit. But President Obama has said he would like to make some kind of direct contact. We're joined now in our studios by John Limbert. He's written a new book with some reflections about how to negotiate with Iran and why he believes it's important. Mr. Limbert is a distinguished professor of international affairs at the U.S. Naval Academy after a career in the U.S. Foreign Service, where he actually taught a course at the University of Shiraz in Iran. And, of course, he was one of the U.S. hostages who were held in Tehran for 444 days from 1979 to 1981. His new book is Negotiating with Iran, Wrestling the Ghosts of History. Thanks very much for being with us, Mr. Limbert.
Thank you very much, Scott. Pleasure to be here.
A lot of people in your position wouldn't want to talk to Iran again at all.
No, that's true. And many people ask me that. They said, with what happened? I should say, in the interest of full disclosure, my ties to Iran go back a very long way, about 45 years.
Well, your wife?
My wife is Iranian, but I was there as a teacher. I was there as a researcher. I was there very briefly as a diplomat.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened in 79 and 80, as unpleasant and as frightening as it was over the long term, was 14 months out of 45-year connection to this really wonderful and intriguing country.
Mm. A lot of Iranians, much less Americans, don't accept Mr. Ahmadinejad as the legitimate ruler of Iran. Does that stand in the way now?
A lot of things stand in the way. That's just another one. People often make negotiation equivalent to surrender or appeasement or weakness. And it is simply not so.
The Iranian government repeated this week, as they do most every week, that development of a nuclear weapon is just nothing that they want to talk about. Secretary of State Clinton repeated this week, well, sorry, that's something we've got to bring up. So what is there to talk about?
This is going to be hard. All I can say is this.
I was hoping for an answer that wouldn't be just, this is going to be hard. Do you see what I mean?
All the answers are hard.
Yeah.
When you're dealing with the 30-year estrangement that we have, it's all hard. But what I can say is this. If you make the nuclear issue the only issue of negotiation, you're guaranteeing its failure. One reason for that is that the Iranians have turned the issue into a question of our rights, justice, and respect. So what you hear is, why is the United States or other powers so upset that we are pursuing a peaceful nuclear program, or what they call a peaceful nuclear program? Now, the point is, there are a lot of things to talk about other than the nuclear issue.
Like?
Such as Afghanistan, such as Iraq, such as security in the Persian Gulf, such as terrorism, such as world narcotics. But if we focus only on one issue, which is going to be one of the most difficult, and I'm sorry for saying it's hard, but it is hard, you're setting yourself up pretty much for failure from the beginning, because you're feeding into this sense or pose, if you like, that the Iranians are going to take.
But you realize the concern of people is that talks will be going on and there might even be some kind of agreements that'll be reached. And in the meantime, Iran develops a nuclear bomb.
Indeed. It is a legitimate concern. But the question is, what are you going to do about it? And one thing you can do about it is at least get some kind of contact going where you can talk to each other. If you can't talk to each other, how can you raise the concerns that you have about this nuclear program? Or is your only method of communication through chest thumping?
You've got a 14-step program that you write about in this book, and I'm sure they're all worthy, but I've isolated a few that we could talk about. Step number four, you say, talk to the right people. Did the Reagan administration do some of that when they were talking to the regime in the 1980s?
Of course it did. This was the whole issue of the arms for hostage deal, or the Iran-Contra. That was one of the case studies that I use in my book, where they were talking to people who were not only misrepresenting their own position, but they were misrepresenting themselves both to the Iranians and to the Americans, and promising more than either side could deliver.
Point number 10, you say, expect grandstanding political theater and flamboyant gestures.
Yes, that seems to be a part of the political culture. And you will particularly find some of these gestures in public, where people will say things like, not one inch, or we will never compromise, we will never do this. But it gets back to the other principle of survival. I mean, if the Iranians would never give in on anything and had stuck to their original positions back in 1979, I and my colleagues would still be prisoners over there, would never have gotten out. So it's yes, you expect these things. You don't write them off completely, but you have to measure them and weigh them and say, all right, what lies behind this?
Mr. Limbert, thanks so much.
Well, thank you, Scott.
John W. Limbert, his new book, Negotiating with Iran, Wrestling the Ghosts of History. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. This week, changes to the U.S. missile defense strategy, and healthcare legislation gets picked apart on Capitol Hill. NPR senior news analyst Dan Shore joins us. Hello, Dan.
Hi, Scott.
And we want to note that because of the Jewish New Year, we are recording this conversation on Friday. Let's start out with foreign news. The Obama administration announced this week that it's going to abandon plans set in place by the Bush administration to establish a missile defense shield in Eastern Europe. Take us through what contributed to this decision.
Well, this is an immensely complicated situation. Let's see if I can reduce it to small, fine parts of it. Let's start with the fact that the greatest threat considered by the United States today is Iran and the possibility of Iran having a nuclear weapon. Mm-hmm. In order to deal with that, they need help from Russia. Mm-hmm. And there may be sanctions, whatever it is, but they want Russia to exert pressure on Iran. Russia was not being very cooperative because of the U.S. plans to establish a missile defense system in the Czech Republic and in Poland, two former satellites of the Soviet Union. So what happens now is that although the administration denies that the politics played any part, they've given up their plans for this missile defense system. That, in turn, creates a brand new problem with Poland, the Czech Republic, and right. most of the other countries, which were all counting on the United States to bring them into NATO. This was, the Russians had said, Medvedev, the president, has said, no, that we cannot permit it to happen. We demand that Russia have privileged interests in the area which was once part of the Soviet Union or satellites. The result is, step by step by step, one problem is solved, another problem is created. Russia is now more or less on board. Now then, the hope for being able to integrate East European countries suffers a terrible blow.
Is the Obama administration saying, when you sweep out some other considerations, that it's more important to placate Russia than it is to have an active partnership with Poland and the Czech Republic and NATO?
Yes, that's exactly what has happened. Russia has a veto in the Security Council of the United States. It will probably need to get sanctions on Iran sometime later in the year and so on. And they can't move very far without Russia. They hold that card, and the Russians are playing that card very cleverly.
And, of course, the U.S. is scheduled to participate in talks with Iran next month. Can you project what impact this decision on missile strategy might have on those talks?
Well, clearly the United States is very anxious to sit down and talk to Iran about the nuclear program. There is no, however, any assurance from the Iranians that they're ready to do that. They only said, you want a meeting, you got a meeting. The president has indicated he wants to reach out to countries like that and talk to them. They say, yeah, we're willing to talk. I think we are pretty far away yet from getting their agreement to give up their nuclear program.
And North Korea's leader now, Kim Jong-il, reportedly is expressing willingness to return to negotiations. Of course, the U.S. hopes that, those talks will lead to shutting down North Korea's nuclear weapons program. Any idea why there seems to be this shift?
Well, I don't want to be pessimistic, but it seems to me that about every 2 or 3 years we hear that North Korea is willing to talk about getting rid of their nuclear weapons, and time passes. They don't allow necessary inspection, and then we are back again. I think that they simply are very, very good at playing the West by saying, yes, go ahead. Meanwhile, they need food, they need fuel. This is a fairly starving country. And so far, if this time they really are serious about getting rid of the nuclear weapon, which has catapulted them to a big position in Asia, I would be surprised.
Of course, health care. This week, Senator Baucus of Montana released his version of a health care overhaul bill. I think it's safe to say that not a lot of people rush to his side.
It is very safe to say that. And he wrote this thing when as part of a group of six that were trying to. In the end, it was he alone who came out with the plan. Senator Rockefeller says against it. Other people, the Republicans, obviously say they are against it. It is very hard to see this getting very far. There will be other plans coming from the House and so on, but they are still stuck in that position, that there is really a fundamental series of divisions between liberals and the conservatives as to which way to go. And I don't see the exit from that very clearly. The one thing I do see, however, is that if this doesn't work, they are prepared to go into the Senate using the so-called reconciliation procedure, which allows them to get things done by a simple majority vote of 51 and not allow for a filibuster. That is probably the way they are headed.
That's what you see as looming ahead in the healthcare overall debate.
That's what I think is looming ahead.
NPR Senior News Analyst Dan Shore, thanks so much.
Thank you.